You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream. Welcome to Feminist Current. I'm your host, Megan Murphy. Today on the show, we'll hear from writer, radical feminist, environmentalist, and food activist, Lear Keith. Lear is the author of The Vegetarian Myth, Food, Justice, and Sustainability, which argues that agriculture is a relentless assault against the planet. Derek Jensen, who we spoke with a couple weeks back on Feminist Current, said the book saved his life. Lear is involved with the Deep Green Resistance Movement. So that's a movement that argues that industrial civilization is endangering all life on the planet, and it advocates for a radical shift in society's structure and function. I spoke with Lear on August 15th, 2012, about the vegetarian myth, the impact of agriculture on our planet, and the ways in which our patriarchal capitalist culture is destructive in most every way. Here is that interview.
There's about a million things that I wanted to talk to you about, so it was really hard for me to trim it down. But I'm sure we'll get opportunities to talk again in the future anyway. But first I wanted to talk to you about veganism, because that's one of the topics that you write about and one of the things that's sort of, I guess, more controversial with people. Right. So I know that a lot of people who are vegans believe that veganism is the most ethical and the most healthy lifestyle for the planet. And you don't agree with that assessment. And in fact, you yourself were vegan for 20 years, is that right?
Just about, yep.
Yeah, and then you went back to eating animal products. So I wonder if you can tell me what brought you back to animal products and why you argue that the vegan diet is not good either for individuals, you know, just for our own health, or for the health of the planet and the longevity of the planet.
Right. Well, I always like to start this conversation by saying that the values that underlie the vegan ethic or the vegetarian ethic are not the problem. So, you know, values like compassion and sustainability and, you know, anything that questions human entitlement or human hubris, those are really the only values that are going to get us to the world that we need, and that's still the moral core of my life, and it always has been. So that's not the problem. I think we have developed the values correct. The problem is, you know, the actions that flow from those values, and I would say that for most people who live in agricultural societies and certainly industrial societies, the problem is ignorance, and it's a very profound cultural ignorance about the nature of nature as opposed to the nature of agriculture. And questioning agriculture is something that almost nobody is willing to do because we live in an agricultural society, and we have now for 10,000 years, and that makes it really hard to question this really basic activity that underlies the entire society. So to put it in really blunt terms, agriculture is, you know, this is the activity. You take a piece of land, and you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So it's biotic cleansing. And so all those species have nowhere to go. And that's a long-winded way of saying mass extinction. And that's what agriculture is. That's not like agriculture on a bad day. That's what it actually is. That's what the activity consists of. So right now, at this point, agriculture has blown through every continent that it could. It's taken all the land that it possibly could. There's no land left. And what that's meant is that 99% of the prairies are gone from the planet. They've simply been eradicated. And 98% of the old growth forests are gone. And that's what agriculture does. It devours. And it devours on a continental scale. It's really hard to make the argument that something that has wiped out 98% of the animal's habitat can possibly be an activity that's good for animals. And the other problem, of course, is that it's drawdown. And what that means is, you know, it can't be sustainable. There's no way to sustain this activity because every single time you do it, you're drawing down all kinds of different resources, starting with living communities, biotic communities, moving on to species. Water, of course, is drawdown of fossil water, and ultimately the soil itself. And this, in the end, is the complete insanity of this activity. Soil is the basis of life, or land life anyway. I mean, we owe our entire existence to 6 inches of soil and the fact that it rains. And what agriculture does is it destroys the soil. every time you clear that land, which you have to do to plant those annual monocrops, you're destroying the soil. So you're removing the plants that should be there, the plants whose job is actually to protect and increase soil, and that would be either trees or grasses, and you're replacing them instead with these domesticated annual plants, which don't just they can't do the same function. They're not meant to in nature, and they don't. And so, you know, just to put a number on that, 1 year of planting those crops, you can destroy 2,000 years of topsoil. And that's why there's no topsoil left now on the planet. We've essentially skinned the planet alive. Now, by the year 1950, the whole thing should have collapsed because at that point, you know, the last chunk of soil was the Great Plains in North America. And that, by 1950, it was gone. Okay, it pretty much had blown through that as well. And, you know, the civilizations usually last between 800 and 1500 years, which is the length that the topsoil holds out doing this activity called agriculture. So that's the pattern, is that, you know, the civilization, there's a power center that grows and it takes from the surrounding area, and then eventually the whole thing collapses as the soil gives out. And that's happened over and over and over across the world as agriculture has spread. Well, by 1950, that should have been the end of it because there weren't any more continents. And what happened instead was what's called the Green Revolution. So the scientists figured out how to make nitrogen out of oil and gas, and that's what we've been eating instead for the last, you know, 60 years. This is not a plan with a future. You know, you can't just flip from one non-renewable resource to another. You know, you can extend it a few decades by doing that, but, you know, in the end, the whole thing is going to collapse. And right now, if you're eating grain, what you're eating is oil on a stalk. So I understand that people think this is the correct way to behave because factory farming is so horrendous, and we can all agree to that, that this has got to stop. But telling people to eat this plant-based diet that ultimately comes from this incredibly destructive activity is not going to save the planet. I mean, in fact, it's the most destructive thing people have done to the planet.
And so how do you respond to arguments around speciesism, like arguments that say that eating animals reinforces some kind of hierarchy and that, you know, humans, I guess, don't have the right to eat animals or something, like those arguments? How do you respond to that part of it?
Well, there's a couple of responses. The first is that there's no way out of this cycle. You can't remove animals from the picture and have a living planet. So the way that a grassland functions, for instance, is that first you've got the soil, and that's the matrix for everything. That's where that basic biological activity that makes life possible, that's where that's happening. And the people who protect the soil are the plants. They have incredible, the perennial plants have incredible root systems, especially prairie plants. And they're the ones who can drop water from far below. And one of their main activities, of course, is to break up rock and bring up minerals. And without that activity of drawing up the minerals, none of us would be here. And then they also absorb rainfall. So when the rain comes, they're able to store it in the soil. And their roots make that all possible. And then without the animals to actually graze through those prairie landscapes, it would actually turn into a desert. You absolutely have to have ruminants on those, in those biotic communities, or else the whole thing is dead eventually. There's a few reasons for that. One is that some plants will outcompete each other without the grazing activity to sort of level the playing field. And the other reason is that grasslands tend to be much drier than forests. That's why they're grasses and not trees. So the biological activity stops once there's not enough water, and it moves instead to the interior of animals' bodies. So it's the ruminants that are actually breaking down the cellulotic material and making the nutrients available again to the rest of the biotic community. So without ruminants, life just comes to a halt in those communities. And then you have another layer on top of that, which is the apex predators, and they keep the ruminants in check. Without them, the ruminants, of course, will overshoot the land's carrying capacity. So everybody plays a role, and in the end, the soil eats us all. There is no way out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I for many years, you know, I looked at my plate and I thought, well, if there's not a dead animal on it, then there's no death on it. And that's way too simplistic of a view, because your choice isn't, you know, is there death on my plate? But really the only question is, what died to get this food onto my plate? Because no matter what you're looking at, something died.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking at agricultural foods, the answer is everything, because it's destroyed the planet. I mean, as Toby Hemingway says, we've had 10,000 years, we've trashed the planet, and that's what agriculture's done. If you're looking at a plate full of food where everything on it participated in soil building activities rather than destroying soil, then you can say this is a plate full. Yes, there's death involved, because there's always death involved in eating, but this was a plate of food that actually helped repair the planet. And that's really the only option we've got. We've got the death that's destroying everything, which is agriculture, and then we've got the death that's participating in those cycles and making them stronger. And I just want to point out that for our first 4 million years on this planet, we were participants. I mean, we were part of those soil-building communities. We had a role to play, and we played it. We ate, and in turn, we were eaten. And that's what nature does. It's just a constant recycling. It's not a hierarchy. We are all participants in our own way, and it's just a matter of time until, you know, every last molecule of my body is eaten, ultimately by plants and then bacteria, and back around, you know, and I will be part of the hawk and part of the bear and part of the salmon and part of the redwoods and part of whoever's here. And it's not mine. It's just on loan. You know, I mean, we're all part of this tribe called Carbon. And, you know, we get our moment and then we're done. And I had a hard time accepting that when I was a vegan. I really, really wanted my life to be possible without death. And I didn't understand that, you know, life and death are the same moment. So I understand that, you know, because in Western culture, especially, you know, coming out of Christianity, there is a hierarchy in the Bible, absolutely. And it's, you know, people, then animals, and then plants, and then that's it. You know, there's not even anybody else that exists. And, of course, you know, as an aside, that's one of the reasons that people like Louis Pasteur had a terrible time, you know, getting Europe to understand that microbes existed. It's because they weren't in the Bible. So there was this whole level of life that they couldn't accept as real because it wasn't mentioned. So how could it be true that there were microbes in the world? Of course, they had microscopes by then, and they could see the activities of these creatures and started to understand how basic they were to, you know, life functions like creating oxygen. But it took a few generations for people to really accept it because the Bible didn't mention them. So there's that hierarchy, and that really goes back to the ancient Greeks as well, that saw, you know, people as the most animate, and animals as sort of animate, and then plants as just dead matter for everybody to eat. And, you know, that is a very patriarchal, hierarchical system. And I would contrast that to pretty much every indigenous life way that anybody's ever come up with, which is that we are all related to each other and we are all simply taking turns. And that's a very different way to look at it. Every single being on this planet is alive and, you know, we have the same substance inside us somehow, which means that we can communicate. So these are all beings with whom we can enter into a relationship, and that relationship needs to be one of respect, of mutual respect. And if we can return to those kinds of relationships, you know, there's still hope that we could repair this planet. But as long as we're still in the hierarchical mode, I don't think there's any hope. But agriculture is the basic activity that embodies that hierarchy most of all, because it simply wipes everything out and puts humans there instead.
I had wanted to talk to you a little bit about soy, because you've written about that a little bit and the problems with soy. Obviously, some of those problems are tied into what you've been discussing here, which is agriculture. But, I mean, aside from that, I know that, you know, a lot of vegans and vegetarians have a fairly large amount of soy in their diets. But I wonder if you can tell me a little more about what you've learned about soy and the problems with soy.
Well, this has a fair amount of personal poignancy for me, because I ended up with Hashimoto's, which is autoimmune disease of the thyroid, and it's, you know, there's a very strong correlation between soy and Hashimoto's or other thyroid problems, so it's pretty clear to me how I got it. So there's a number of problems with soy. The first is the phytoestrogens, and these are chemicals that plants produce essentially to protect themselves from being eaten. They're really good at chemical warfare, and that's because they can't move. So the way they protect themselves is by producing all kinds of chemical substances that are toxic to animals, and especially their seeds are filled with all kinds of things that make them inedible because they don't want to be eaten. They want to be carried in some cases, but that means they have to be able to survive an animal's digestive tract so that they'll come out the other end in a new place, and that's how they locomote, if they rely on animals. And the only way that's going to happen is if they're indigestible, if the animal cannot actually digest them. And so most seeds, in fact, are quite indigestible to humans. And I would say soy is pretty much at the top of the list. So phytoestrogens are one way that plants fight back. And what this means is, you know, you eat me, and I will make it impossible for you to reproduce. And that's what phytoestrogens do. They look a lot like estrogens, so they will lock into your estrogen receptors in your body, but it will make it impossible for actual estrogen to lock on instead and do its job for you. And this is why there's tremendous correspondences between things like breast cancer and soy consumption and phytoestrogens, all kinds of reproductive issues that women end up with from eating soy. My sister ended up with endometriosis from eating soy. She was also a long-term vegan and had a hysterectomy in the end from it. Uterine polyps, uterine fibroids, all of this is, you know, highly indicated if you're a heavy soy eater. And then a lot of people say, well, but don't they eat a lot of soy in Asia? Well, they don't eat a lot of soy in Asia. They don't actually eat it as a protein source. The way that soy is consumed in Asia, it's really interesting. It's eaten as a condiment, and it's highly fermented before it's eaten. Mm. And the fermentation actually breaks down some of those anti-nutrients that are in very high quantities in soy. So if you eat something like miso, it's been fermented, you know, for months, if not years. And that's the reason why people do it, is that it does make it more digestible. But the way that we're being told to eat soy, which is it's not fermented at all, and in fact it's highly processed, it's an industrial waste product essentially, because they squeezed the oil out and then they had all this protein left over. Well, what are we going to do with it? So they figured out ways to make it sort of slightly palatable to people. But that's what you're eating when you eat soy, is a highly extruded industrial waste product. It's been, you know, subjected to these very extreme high temperatures, which create a tremendous number of carcinogens, frankly. Okay, so the phytoestrogens is one problem. Then you've got the things in seeds that are called trypsin inhibitors, and trypsin is it's an enzyme secreted by your pancreas that you need for digestion. And again, this is the seed's way of saying, if you eat me, I'm not going to let you digest me. And so this is why a lot of people get all kinds of gas and bloating and stomach pains when they eat soy, is because of the trypsin inhibitors. And then it's got this goitrogenic effect, so the thyroid problems that come from eating soy. The disease that I have, Hashimoto's, you'll notice that's a Japanese name. It was a Japanese doctor who got his name, you know, the disease is named after him. And indeed, it's from eating soy. They've known this really since the 30s, that people with thyroid problems shouldn't eat soy, but it absolutely can trigger all kinds of thyroid problems. It also, soy interferes. There's an enzyme that's produced by the hippocampus in your brain, which is about memory. And this is why, even anecdotally, I know so many vegans who have tremendous memory problems. That enzyme is suppressed. The production of that enzyme is suppressed when you eat soy products. So it will affect your brain. I would highly, highly recommend that before anybody eats soy that they read up on this. Mm-hmm. It's a huge industry in the United States. It's one of the biggest agricultural commodities. So there's been a tremendous push to get people to accept soy. And this includes lots of PR campaigns. You can read all the background about this and some of the memos that were leaked to the public about it. But their basic approach was, well, if we can get, you know, upper middle class people to accept this as a lifestyle, you know, that soy is part of a healthy lifestyle that involves yoga and whatever else, it will then trickle down to the rest of the culture. And that was correct, and that started in the 70s. Up until that point, people sort of laughed at soy. It was a serious poverty food that was only fed to people in institutions like prisons. Mm. And they were able to get, you know, upper middle class people to accept this as something that was good for them. And indeed, it has trickled down now. You can buy soy milk everywhere. Mm-hmm. But before you eat a lot of soy, and especially before you give it to your children, I would highly recommend doing a little poking around to get some more information so that you can make a better decision. But particularly with the phytoestrogens in children, if you are feeding children infant soy formula, that is a hormone load equivalent to taking 4 birth control pills every day. There is no possible way that a human infant should be taking birth control pills, and that's what you're doing if you give your baby soy formula. So, and this again is another, I mean, the girls who have the precocious puberty that's happening in the United States, I don't know if you have it as bad in Canada, but it's terrible here, and every year it's getting worse. We've got girls as young as 7 and 8 already having their menstrual periods. Mm-hmm. It's especially bad in for African-American women, for girls. And it sets them up for a lifetime of just tremendous reproductive suffering. And one of the reasons is the soy. If you are an African-American woman, a woman on the WIC program, which is one of the food programs for low-income women, it's almost impossible to get anything except soy infant formula for your children. So that means that this is an experiment now that's been done for a generation on these young girls. And, you know, one of the results is this horrible precocious puberty. and somewhere around 50% of African American girls have some signs of precocious puberty. This is a science experiment that's being done on the poor. Really should be outraged about this, and there isn't. And it really frightens me that there's not. I mean, there was a huge campaign about, you know, Nestle and the infant formula in the third world. Well, it's happening here, and nobody seems to care. And it makes me wonder if, you know, the left is so attached to soy as, you know, the great messiah that they won't question it. So nobody wants to take this on. But it's really horrible what's happening to these young girls.
Yeah, I actually wasn't aware of that. So it's horrifying, but it's really good information to know. I mean, so the problem with eating animal products in our culture, at least one of the biggest problems, is as you mentioned earlier, factory farming, which is horrific and destructive and awful. And of course it makes sense that we would want to avoid that at all costs. But, you know, how can we eat healthfully and ethically and survive on this planet at the same time, especially while incorporating animal products, but just in general, I mean, what would that look like?
Well, there's a couple ways to approach that, and one is just personally. You know, I, as someone who's trying to be ethical, what should I do? And then there's the second level of that, which is, as a culture, what are we going to do? So for the first level, the best thing you can do is ask yourself, does this food build topsoil or does it destroy topsoil? Because if you're building topsoil, chances are you're providing habitat for animals that need it. Chances are you're restoring the water table. Chances are you are repairing the riparian, you know, the waterways that are under such assault from agriculture. And chances are very good that there's no fossil fuel involved because grasslands, prairie systems are self-sustaining. You don't need to add any inputs because it's exactly what nature has done for, you know, a few million years now. And so that would include mostly ruminants on grass. It would include other animals as well because to have a system that's actually resilient and that sort of includes every function that you need for it to be a closed loop, there's other animals as well that are probably going to be part of it. I mean, there's no standalone system that's just a ruminant and grass. I mean, there are always birds. There are always other small mammals. You know, there's going to be amphibians. There's, you know, all kinds of creatures that need to be there as well. But if you have the perennial polyculture, if you have the grass and you have the ruminants, the other creatures will come home. And this is what, you know, you see over and over again when you go to farms that have made the transition to grass-based farming. There's just this incredible, this lushness of life that returns, and often within the first year. And I have talked to so many farmers now who have done this on their land. And, I mean, they've got tears in their eyes because they've seen birds that they haven't seen since, you know, they were young children. So it's been 50 or 60 years since they've seen, you know, these birds, and now they're back. And it's because they've got habitat again. So try to find the farms in your area. You will not be able to buy this food at the store, or it's unlikely, unless you've got a really great local grocery store. You'll have to find the farmers, and you'll have to go get the food. And the best website about this is eatwild.com, which is run by a wonderful woman named Jo Robinson. And she also wrote a book called Pasture Perfect. And she will walk you through everything, why this is so important, what it means, how helpful it is, what it will do for your health, what it will do for the planet. And then on her website, you can click on whatever state or province you're in and find all the farms that are doing it right. And that's the best way to get the food. And it's the best thing for the farmer, because the more they can cut out the middleman, the more profit they will get, the more likely it is that they can actually afford to keep farming. So it's the best thing for everybody. And I think it's really important, too, for people to have a personal relationship with the farm, with the animals, with the land, with the grass, with all the creatures that are living there and making that resilient biotic community again. It's really important to see it. And it's important to see where your food comes from, and to develop those personal relationships, I think, is a really key thing, just emotionally as well as politically. So find that food. Go to eatwild.com. There's other websites too, but that's the best one. But that's the basic question. Is my food, is it producing topsoil or is it destroying topsoil? So that really is going to mean some kind of large animal on grass at this point. And then, you know, the other animals that are also part of it. So you can get eggs that are from pasture-raised hens. Usually that's part of the whole farm system. Or, you know, it could be ducks, it could be turkeys. There's, you know, all kinds of poultry that can be introduced into it as well. But they play a really important role because they'll eat the bugs and they keep the larger animals from the diseases and the pests that can really, you know, infect them. It keeps it much cleaner for everybody because everybody is eating at a slightly different level. So you do need somebody to break up the manure and to eat the bugs in the manure, and that's what poultry do. That's why birds follow ruminants. You're not going to find a ruminant in nature that does not have birds following behind. And they have these incredible relationships sometimes where the birds actually ride on the backs of the different animal, other animals, the mammals, and will groom them, you know, eat the bugs off their coats and stuff. And even you can see pictures of the animals staying there with their eyes shut. You know, they'll be like bison or, you know, wildebeest or whoever, and they've got their eyes shut, and the birds are like literally picking little bugs mm-hmm. out from around their eyes. So these, you know, these are clearly relationships that are very tender and, mm-hmm. and very trustful. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I let anybody near my eyes, especially with a beak. Mm. I think for this continent, you know, and this is back to the big political level, the only hope we've really got is the bison. It's the bison that have to come home. And that means, you know, huge swaths of the Great American Prairie have got to be restored. If we were able to restore 75% of the world's trashed grasslands, and let's be clear, they've been trashed for agriculture. If we were able to restore those to grass, it would only take about 15 years, and those plants could sequester enough carbon that it would be essentially all the carbon that's produced since the beginning of the industrial age. And that's an incredible statistic. But in 15 years, we could stop global warming dead in its tracks. And all we have to do is let the plants and the animals come home. We just have to stop fighting this war against the planet, declare a truce, and let the planet do the repair itself. And it's not too late, I guess is what I'm saying. But we need a totally different economic system to go with that. And as part of that, of course, a totally different food system. And that's where it gets political, because mm-hmm. this isn't going to happen one by one. I mean, there's just huge changes that have to be made on a public policy level, and then that has to trickle down into the culture so that we all understand how important it is to buy this food rather than the food that's, you know, based on those destructive activities. But mm-hmm. this is food that could repair the planet, not just our health, but really, I think it's the only hope we've got at this point.
And that's something else I wanted to talk to you. I mean, obviously making personal change is important and valuable in terms of how we live. But there's also this idea that's sort of problematic that some people have bought into, you know, a lot to do with the kind of new agey stuff. But it's that idea that says that we can live by example. So we can change the world by demonstrating good or ethical behavior ourselves. And then in doing so, this behavior will spread and will affect change. So, you know, tied to this sort of individualism that's so popular, especially within the West, that first of all, that all we can do is change ourselves, that's all we have control over or power over, that's the best that we can do, and then that just making personal change will have a larger impact. So what, you know, what do you think about that idea?
Well, I like to say that the task of an activist is not to navigate around systems of oppression with as much personal integrity as possible. It's actually to destroy those systems, to dismantle those systems. So, you know, we can live these super, uber pure lives, but at the end of the day, it really doesn't matter. I mean, it has nano effect. There are no personal solutions to political problems. And the only thing that's going to change systems of oppression is, you know, people making common cause and actually doing direct confrontations with power, and either taking over institutions or dismantling the institutions and then rearranging toward justice so that we actually control the material conditions of our lives, and so dismantling those hierarchies. And there's no way to do that as an individual. I mean, it simply can't be done. And this really cuts to one of the main differences between liberals and radicals, because liberals think that society is made up of individuals. And that's really core to the liberal ideology. So, I mean, to the point where saying that somebody is a member of a group is actually seen as an insult. So, you know, saying somebody's a woman or saying somebody's a person of color, you know, pointing that out is, you know, somehow an insult that, you know, we're all, you know, supposed to be exactly, you know, the same, equal, whatever, and then there are no distinctions. And that just completely overlooks the fact that there is brutal, corrupt, horrendous, violent power arrangements on this planet, and that, you know, it's only by making common cause with others and understanding that we share a class condition. That's a liberating moment. And just psychologically, but when you actually make that common cause and build those movements, that's the only thing that changes those power arrangements. So there's no insult in, you know, claiming that, you know, you're part of an oppressed group. And in fact, it's really the first step toward liberation. And that's one of the main differences between liberals and radicals. So for liberals, of course, it's only individuals that can change, because that's the basic unit of society. Whereas for radicals, you know, you have to join forces with people who are in the same position that you are, And allies too, of course, and then you can fight as a group. Then you've got some kind of political power that you can try to dismantle the oppressive system. So for whatever reason, we don't, you know, the left in this country has really just, it's been saturated with this kind of liberal ideology and forgotten what it used to know in terms of being radical. I don't know how bad it is in Canada, but I think in the United States we really have not had an honest-to-God left since about the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
So we've had liberals since then, and we've certainly had leftist people who've tried very hard, but as a movement, we really have not had a radical movement. We haven't had a true left. It's really just evolved into this kind of individualism, which, of course, segues very neatly into the demands of this sort of globalized corporate neoliberalism, because they want us to see ourselves as individuals who only have private lives, which are defined by consumption.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is exactly what they want. And to have people who believe in social change take this up as a tactic just seems bizarre to me, but that's where things stand right now. Okay, so having said that, personal example. Well, literally the history of the world, the last 10,000 years written history, is the story of the imperialist agriculturalist societies. I mean, what happens is, okay, so what is civilization? Well, it's people living in cities, which means that they're living in concentrations large enough that they've used up the resource base of the land where they live, and then they have to go out and get those resources from somewhere else. So the food, the water, the energy, there isn't any left where people live. Okay, so they've got to go out and get it. And the problem is that nobody gives up those things willingly. And this is why agricultural societies always end up militarized. It's because they're on drawdown. Okay, they've taken what they can from their own land base. There are no more trees. There's no more water. There's no more soil. And they have to go get those. So that's the pattern of civilization. You've got a big city in the center that's the power center. And then you've got conquered colonies all around it. And that conquered area spreads and spreads and spreads. And eventually it reaches a breaking point. And throughout history, until very recently, civilizations could only get so big, and the reason was transportation. The supplies essentially had to be hauled on pack animals, and it was only so long that those supply chains could stretch until they broke. And then also the military orders had to go from CENTCOM out to the hinterlands, and again, that took time, and it was only so long that those command chains could reach before they snapped. So Rome could only get so big. The Roman Empire was only going to get so big. And Rome could never get into northern Europe because the Alps got in the way. There was no way to get across the mountains. So, you know, it conquered the whole Mediterranean region because they were boats, so it was easier. But along the way, I mean, you know, the rest of North Africa was completely deforested to, you know, to provide for Rome. Egypt was a personal possession of the emperor because of the grain that it produced. And anybody who interfered with the offloading of grain into various Roman ports, they were killed by summary execution. That's how important it was. Everybody knew that if there was even a day of hunger, there would be just gigantic revolt across the cities. So anyway, these civilizations, you know, up until very recently, they were still human scale. And when they collapsed, it meant that there was some place to go, that people could go back to some of their traditional life ways. There was still a wilderness. Or, you know, I shouldn't even say that word, but there were still indigenous people that hadn't been conquered, and you could return to your people. And that's over now. Everything's been conquered. Once fossil fuel entered the picture, it was over because, you know, the boundary of that transportation was snapped, and now the whole thing's gone completely global. There's nothing to stop it, and that means that the whole world's been conquered. Okay, so that's been the last 10,000 years. Is that pattern of, you know, something that the power center arises and then it conquers and then the whole thing collapses when the topsoil is completely gone. All right. So over all that 10,000 years, over all those conquerings, over all that those imperialist endeavors, over and over and over, you've got this dominating sociopathic, militaristic, imperialist culture coming into contact with who? With the neighboring indigenous people. And some of those people were, and still are, matrilineal, peaceful, egalitarian, sustainable cultures. Okay, over and over and over, that's the pattern. And what has happened? Never once has the face-to-face example of an egalitarian, sustainable, peaceful culture changed the invaders. Okay, that's never once in 10,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
They have seen living examples. And over, what have they done? Their best to wipe them out and take the resources.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still going on in North America. Still going on in South America. There's still parts of Africa where it's going on, parts of Asia. And, you know, there's people fighting for their mountains in India. There are people fighting to stop the Belo Monte Dam. You know, all over the world, this is still the pattern. They've got something that the invaders want. Do the invaders care what beautiful, peaceful, wonderful cultures they? No. They take what they want. And it doesn't matter whether it's coal, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, aluminum, it doesn't, whatever the resource is, they will take it. And it doesn't matter. So there's no evidence, none, that personal example works to bring in any broad-based change, because it never has. So, you know, that's just history. And I think people need to accept this, because we're kind of at the end point here. You know, we're up against the wall. We're going over the cliff, whatever metaphor you want to use. Things are bad. And these sort of quasi-solutions that we're being handed in no way match the scale of the problem. And most of them are simply magical thinking.
Mm-hmm. And I want to, of course, touch on patriarchy and how patriarchy plays into all of this. I mean, the relationship between patriarchy and civilization and agriculture and the destruction of the planet. Can you talk a little bit about that relationship and how that's tied together?
Sure. I would say that, you know, patriarchy is a system that takes human beings that are born either biologically male or female, and then it turns them into social classes of people called men and women. Any system of oppression tries to make a claim that this is natural or that it was, you know, created by God. And either way, you can't fight it. I mean, it's bigger than you can't fight City Hall. This is, you can't fight nature, you can't fight God, you can't fight the cosmos. And patriarchy is no different. So it creates these two classes using some pretty brutal socialization practices and then tries to tell us, well, this is natural. Well, if it's so natural, you know, why do these terrible things have to be done to children to get them to conform to this? So for little boys, of course, you know, they're socialized to become men. And the psychology that they're socialized to is really the psychology that's necessary for soldiers. So they have to be emotionally numb, and they have to have an incredible amount of entitlement, especially to people called women. And then the final thing is there's a psychology that is called a negative reference group, and it means that you can turn people who are not you into others. And so they're not human. You know, you can look around the world and say, this group of people is not like me. They embody certain things that I will never be, and those other things make them subhuman. So they're objects to be used, they're people to be exploited, but they're not human. And, of course, in patriarchy, the first group that boys, that the template for this is how boys treat girls. And, you know, the number of times that I've met otherwise, you know, reasonable, progressive people who will say things like, oh, well, my son is just going through his I hate girls phase. And I always just draw them up short. Said, okay, if your little boy came home and he said that about, you know, the Jewish kids in the class, you tell me that would be okay to you? You know, you would be able to say, oh, he's just going through, you know, his I hate indigenous people phase. And, of course, they're horrified at this thought. And, but it's okay to say, well, it's his I hate girls phase. And then they try to pull this thing, well, you know, they grow out of it. I'm like, where's the evidence? Battering is the most commonly committed crime in the United States, violent crime. That's a man beating up a woman. Where is the evidence that they grow out of this? They don't grow out of this. This is set up for life. They hate girls, and they grow on to hate women. So that's in the basic template, is they're able to turn a whole group of people into other. And then when you live in a militaristic, imperialist society that needs soldiers, it's really simple. You can fill in that category with any other group of people that the dominant society needs oppressed. So it's really simple. You can just call them whatever hate speech you want, and now they're subhuman and can be, you know, killed with impunity. So this is why patriarchy and militarism tend to go together. It's because it's the same psychology that's necessary for soldiers. Okay, so that's what it takes to turn boys into men. And I will say it's a fairly brutal process. I watched what happened to my brother when I was growing up. He went from being a pretty sweet little kid to, you know, being a pretty horrifying adult. And, you know, I don't really understand why more men are not pro-feminists, because I don't think it's any fun being a man. They certainly get all the power and the privilege. I mean, I get that part of it, certainly, but I don't really understand, you know, emotionally, it's no fun having someone and be, you know, dominating. And the other thing it creates is this violation imperative. So men prove, they become real men. You know, you're never really a man. You can never be a real man in patriarchy. It's something that always has to be proved. And ultimately, it's because they're suppressing, you know, the parts of human beings that make life worthwhile. So it's, you know, their connection to others, that the care and the compassion that we're all capable of. You can never do that enough, right? It's a constant battle you have to wage. So it's a battle that's never won. So they're constantly having to prove that they're men. And the way that they do that, of course, is by violating. So this is the violation imperative that's really intrinsic to masculinity. So men become real men by hurting and by violating. And you can see this in boys. You know, they learn to torture insects, and they learn to hurt animals, and then they, you know, they go on to girls and women. Mm-hmm. And that's how they become real men. So there's that violation imperative. Now, that violation imperative, it sort of joined forces with these other social systems like civilization, like capitalism, which are also based on violation and on, and certainly on domination. So at this point, it feels like it's just one huge feedback loop. It's just one huge sort of, you know, sociopathic feeding frenzy out there of destruction. So whether it's violating, like, the boundaries of women and girls, whether it's violating the boundaries of, you know, forests and prairies and rivers, whether it's violating the boundaries of the moon, whether it's violating the boundaries of the genetic code. So we've got, like, transgenic salmon now and all this, you know, genetically modified corn and soy and wheat. You know, they're breaking the boundaries of DNA. And ultimately, the boundaries of the atom itself with, you know, the atom bomb. All of this is based on that violation imperative that they have to keep violating. But there's nothing that's sacrosanct. There's no way to say no. The moment that anybody says no, that's a boundary they're going to have to break to keep proving that they're men. And so this is why I think you can't be an environmentalist without being a feminist, and you can't be a peace activist without being a feminist, and you can't be a peace activist without being an environmentalist. And I don't actually care which direction you come at this from or what your work is in the world, because God knows there's plenty of good work to do. Mm-hmm. But all of it, yeah, I think this is what radical feminists bring to the table. You've got to understand that masculinity is core to this, so that violation imperative that half the population has been socialized to, that is what underlies all of it. So they don't just, this is the brilliance of patriarchy, they don't just naturalize oppression, they don't just say, well, this is the way nature made us, or this is, you know, God's work. They take those acts of oppression and they turn them into, they eroticize them. So domination and subordination are eroticized into sexual acts. So they're experienced as sex by most people in this culture. Mm-hmm. And they're institutionalized then into masculinity and femininity. So then it just seems like, you know, this is how people are supposed to behave because it's institutionalized. So first it naturalizes it, then it eroticizes it, and then it institutionalizes it. And that, to me, is a really brilliant system. And I think that's one of the reasons that patriarchy is really hard to dislodge. You know, this is, it's really brilliant.
Yeah.
And the only thing we've got on our side is that, you know, as feminists, we figured that out. So at least we're onto their game.
Yeah, exactly. That's a start. We've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much. That was really wonderful. I really enjoyed talking with you, and I'm really glad that we got the chance to connect. And thank you so much for your work. It's really wonderful and impactful, and I'm so glad that I came across your work. It was introduced to me by some feminists and some women. But so thank you again for your time.
No, thank you for your time, and I'm so happy that you have your radio show. It's a little shining star. It's just wonderful to have actual radical feminism being discussed somewhere in some public venue. But without this analysis, the planet's dead. I don't mean to sound hyperbolic, but everything's going in the wrong direction. And people have got to understand, you know, these connections or we're sunk.
Completely, yeah, I completely agree.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you, take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye.
You just heard an interview with author and activist Lier Keith. For more on her work, please visit lierkeith.com. I'm Megan Murphy, and that is all the time we have for today. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current.
Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.